Before we start our episode today, I want to talk a little bit about a hard topic, fertility. If you are one of the many women struggling to become pregnant again, just know that we're thinking of you and sending you the most positive thoughts. For mamas trying to conceive or struggling with fertility, I encourage you to check out Needed. When the two founders of Needed began their fertility journey, they were shocked to see the lack of nutrition advice provided. Along with creating an amazing line of prenatal vitamins, omega-3s, and other essentials, they offer egg quality support for women and sperm plus for men. These are things that are not often talked about. I wanted to share more about both of those products. Needed's egg quality support is designed to support egg cell health as they develop into mature eggs. Improving egg quality can support fertility outcomes. It's never too early or too late to start focusing on egg quality, but for optimal results, they recommend taking egg support at least 3 months before trying to conceive or freezing the eggs. For Needed Sperm Support Plus, it combines targeted and clinically studied ingredients, pre and probiotics, antioxidants, and botanicals for the whole body approach to male fertility. Expertly formulated for men who are thinking of trying to conceive and for men's vitality at stages of all life. If you are pregnant or trying to conceive, or even in your postpartum stages, consider switching to Needed to get 20% off your order by using code VBAC20. That is thisisneeded.com and use code VBAC20 at checkout. Hey guys, so this is one of our rebroadcasted episodes. This is an episode that, in my opinion, is a little gem in the podcast world of the VBAC Link. I really have loved this podcast ever since the date we recorded it. I am a huge fan of Dr. Stu Fishbein and Midwife Bliss, have been since the moment I knew that they existed. I absolutely love listening to their podcast and just all of the amazing things that they have and that they offer. So I wanted to rebroadcast this episode because it was quite down there. It was like our 73rd episode or something like that. And yeah, I love it so much. And this week is OB week. And so I thought it'd be fun to kick off the week with one of my favorite OBs, Dr. Stuart Fishbein. So, little recap of what this episode covers. We go over a lot. We asked for our community to ask questions for these guys, and we kind of went through them, and we didn't get to everything. So that was kind of a bummer, but we did get to quite a bit. And we talked about things like the chances of VBAC. We talked about the chances of uterine rupture, the signs of uterine rupture. We talked about inducing VBAC. We talked about uterine abnormalities, the desire of where you want to birth and figuring that out. And also, Bliss had a really great analogy to talk about what to do and how we're letting the medical world and of insurance and things like that really contemplate dictate where we are birthing. And I love that analogy. You guys, seriously, so many questions. It's an episode that you'll probably want to put on repeat because it really is so great to listen to them. And they just speak so directly. I can't get enough of it. So I'm really excited for you guys to dive in today on this. However, I wanted to bring to your attention a couple of the new things that they've had since we recorded this way back when. I also wanted to point out that we will have updated notes in the show notes or updated links in the show notes so you can go check them out. But one of the first things I wanted to mention was their Patreon. They have a Patreon these days, and I think that it just sounds dreamy. So I think you should definitely go find your community in their Patreon. Find their community through their Patreon. You can check it out at patreon.com/birthinginstinctspodcast.com. And of course, you can find them on social media. You can find Dr. Stu at Birthing Instincts or his website at birthinginstincts.com. You can find Bliss, and that is BLYSS if you are looking for her, at Birthing Bliss on Instagram or birthingbliss.com. And then, of course, you can email them. They do take emails with questions, and sometimes they even talk about it on their podcast. Their podcast is birthinginstinctspodcast.com, and then you can email them at birthinginstinctspodcast@gmail.com. So definitely check them out. Also, Dr. Stu offers some classes and workshops and things like that throughout the years, and things like breech, a topic of breech. And yeah, you guys, I love them and really can't wait for you to listen to today's episode.
Hi, my name is Megan. Welcome to the VBAC Link podcast. I am a VBAC after two C-section mama, a wife, doula, and VBAC educator. This podcast was created to hold space for those wanting to know their options for birth after cesarean. It is a space where you will likely find yourself getting better educated, relate to stories like your own, and finding the inspiration to help you have a better birth experience. Although we will be sharing stories related to cesarean and VBAC, this podcast is for anyone and everyone who wants to receive evidence-based information and learn how to avoid unnecessary or undesired cesareans. The purpose of this podcast is to educate and inform. It is not meant to replace advice from any other medical professional. Ladies, I cannot tell you how giddy excited I have been for the last couple weeks since we knew that these guys were going to record with us. But we have some amazing special guests today. We have Dr. Stuart Fishbein and midwife Bliss Young. And we want to share a little bit about them before we get into the questions that all of you guys have asked on our social media platforms.
Absolutely. And when Megan says we're excited, like, we are really excited.
My
like,
face is hot right now because I'm so excited.
And Megan was texting me last night at 11 o'clock in all caps, total fangirling out over here. So Dr. Stu and midwife Bliss are pretty amazing, and we know that you are going to love them just as much as we do. But before we get into it, and like Megan said, I'm just going to read their bio so you can know just how legit they really are. First up, Dr. Stuart Fishbein, MD, is a fellow of the American College of Obstetrics and Gynecology, and you know how much we love ACOG over here at the VBAC Link. He's a published author of the book Fearless Pregnancy, Wisdom and Reassurance from a Doctor, a Midwife, and a Mom. And he has peer-reviewed papers, Home Birth with an Obstetrician, a series of 135 out-of-hospital births and breech birth at home, outcomes of 60 breech and 109 cephalic planned home and birth center births. Dr. Stu is a lecturer and advocate who now works directly with home birthing midwives. His website is www.birthinginstincts.com, and his podcast is Dr. Stu's podcast. Seriously, guys, you
Go
need to just subscribe
right now to their podcast.
And the website for his podcast is drstuspodcast.com. He has an international following. He offers hope for women who cannot find supportive practitioners for VBAC and twin and breech deliveries. Guys, this is the home birth OB. He is located in California. So if you are in California hoping for a VBAC, especially if you have any special circumstance like after multiple cesareans, twins, or breech presentation, run to him. Run. Go find him. He will help you. Go to that website. Bliss, midwife Bliss, we really love them. If you haven't had
love
a chance
her.
To hear their podcast, guys, really go and give them a listen because this duo is on point. They are on fire and they talk about all of the real topics in birth. So his partner on the podcast is Bliss Young, and she is an LM and CPM. She has been involved in the natural birth world since the birth of her first son in 1992. First as an advocate and then as an educator. She is a mother of three children and all of her pregnancies were supported by midwives, two of which were triumphant, empowering home births. In 2006, Bliss co-founded the Sanctuary Birth and Family Wellness Center. This was a culmination of all of her previous experience as a natural birth advocate, educator, and environmentalist. The Sanctuary was the first of its kind, a full-spectrum center where midwives, doctors, and other holistic practitioners collaborated to provide thousands of Los Angeles families care during the prenatal and postpartum periods. Bliss closed the Sanctuary in 2015 to pursue her long-held dream of becoming a midwife and care for her clients in an intimate home birth practice similar to the way she was cared for during her pregnancies. I think that's kind of why Megan and I both became doulas,
exactly,
too.
That's exactly why I'm a doula.
Like, we needed to provide that care just like we had been cared for. Anyways, going on. Currently, Bliss, a.k.a. Birthing Bliss, supports families on their journey as a birth center educator, placenta encapsulator, and a natural birth and family consultant and home birth midwife. She is also co-founder of Just Placentas, a company servicing all of Southern California, and placenta encapsulation and other postpartum services. And, as you know, she is a co-host on the Dr. Seuss podcast.
And she has a class. Don't you have a class that you're doing? Don't you have a class?
Am I correct?
Yeah. She has a class that she's doing, which I want to just fly out because I know you're not doing it like online and everything yet, but I just want to fly there just to take your class.
Yeah.
It's coming online.
It is? Yay! Great. Well, yes. I'll be one of those first registering. Oh, did you put it in there?
Yeah, no, there's a little bit more.
Oh, well, I'm just getting ahead of
myself. I just want to read more of Bliss over here.
Okay.
Because I love this and I think it's so important. At the heart of all Bliss's work is a deep-rooted belief in the brilliant design of our bodies, the symbiotic relationship between baby and mother, the power of the human spirit, and the richness that honoring birth and the right as a rite of passage and passage and resurrecting lost traditions can bring to our high-tech, low-touch lives. And isn't that true?
I love
that language. Yeah. It is so beautiful. If I'm not mistaken, Midwife Bliss's website is Birthing Bliss. .com, is that right? And Bliss is spelled with a Y, so BLYSS, birthingbliss.com, and that's where you can find her.
Yay!
Just to make it more complicated, I had to put a Y in there.
Hey, I love
that's
it.
Okay.
Hey, we're in Utah, so like we have all sorts of weird names over here.
Yep, I love it. You're unique. Awesome. Well, we will get started.
I did read through these questions, and one of the things that I wanted to say that I thought we could kind of let people know is that, of course, there's a little bit more that we need to take into consideration when we have a uterus that's already had a scar, that has a scar, right? Mm-hmm. So there's a small percentage of a uterine rupture that we need to be aware of, and we need to know what are the signs and symptoms that we would need to take a different course of action. But besides that, I believe that, and Dr. Stu can speak for himself because we don't always practice together. I believe that we treat VBACs just like any other mom who's laboring.
Yes.
So a lot of these questions, could go into a category that you could ask about a woman who is having her first baby. I don't really think that we need to differentiate between those.
Love it.
But I do think that in terms of preparation, there are some special considerations for moms who have had a previous cesarean. And probably the biggest one that I would point to is the trauma.
Yes.
And giving space to and processing the trauma and really helping these moms have a provider that really believes in them, I think is one of the biggest factors to them having success.
Absolutely.
So that's one I wanted to say before you started down the question.
Absolutely. And, you know, that's actually the very first. So we have an online class that we provide for VBAC prep. And that's the very first section is mentally preparing and physically preparing, because there's so much that goes into that. So I love that you started out with that.
Yeah. A lot of these women that come searching for VBAC and realize that there's another way besides a repeat cesarean are processing a lot of trauma. And a lot of them realize that their cesarean might have been prevented had they known better, had a different provider, prepared differently, and things like that. And processing that and realizing that is heavy, and it's really important to do before we feel like here, before getting into anything else preparation wise.
Yeah.
One of the best things I ever, like a distinction that one of my VBAC moms made for me, and I've passed it on as I've cared for other VBAC moms, is, you know, for her, the kind of justification, or I can't find the right word for it, but she basically said that statement that we hear so often of, yeah, you have trauma from this, or you're not happy about how your birth went, but thank God your baby is healthy.
And safe.
She said it felt so invalidating for her because, yes, she also was happy, of course, that her baby was safe. But at the same time, she had this experience and this trauma that wasn't being acknowledged and she felt like was just really being kind of brushed away.
Yeah.
And so, you know, I think really giving women that space to be able to say, yes, that's valid. It's valid how you feel. And it is a really important part of the process in having a successful vaginal delivery, this go around.
Yeah, you know, I tend to be a lightning rod for stories. It's almost like I have my own personal ICANN meeting pretty much almost every day, one-on-one. I get contacted, or just today driving, I'm in San Diego today and just driving down here, I talked to two people on the phone, both of whom, Liz really just touched on it, is that they both are wanting to have VBACs with their second birth, and they were seeing practitioners who are encouraging them to be induced for this reason or that reason. And they both have been told the same thing that Bliss just mentioned, that if you end up with a repeat cesarean, at least you'll have you're going to have a healthy baby. And it's very important. But the thing is that I know it's a cliche, but it's not just about the destination. It's about the journey as well. And one of the things that we're not taught in medical school and residency program is that the value of the process. I mean, we're very much mechanical in the OB world, and our job is to get the baby out and head it to the pediatric department, and then we're done with it. So if we can get somebody induced early, if we can decide to do a C-section sooner than we should, there's a lot of incentives to do that and to not keep the process, and think about the process and think about the person, there's another cliche which we talk about all the time. Listen, I've said it many times, is that, the baby is the candy and the mother's the wrapper. I don't know if you've heard that one, but when the baby comes out, the mother just gets basically tossed aside, and her experience is really not important to the medical professionals that are taking care of her in the hospital setting, especially in today's world where you have a shift mentality and a lot of people are being taken care of by people they didn't know. And you guys mentioned earlier the importance of feeling safe and feeling secure in whatever setting you're in, whether that's at home or in the hospital, because as Bliss knows, I get off on the mammalian track, and you talk about mammals, and they just don't labor well when they're anxious.
Yep.
And when the doctor or the health professional is anxious, and they're projecting their anxiety onto the mom, then and the family, then that stuff is brewing for weeks, if not months, and it, who knows what it's actually doing inside, but it's certainly not going to lead to the likelihood of. Or it's going to diminish the likelihood of a successful labor.
Yeah, absolutely. We talk about that. We go over that a lot. Like, birth is very instinctual and very primal, and it operates at a very fundamental core level. And whenever mom feels threatened or anxious or anything like that, it literally can stall or stop labor from progressing or even starting.
Yeah, when I was trying to VBAC with my first baby, my doctor came in and told my husband to tell me that I needed to wake up and smell the coffee because it wasn't happening for me. And that was the last contraction I remember feeling was right before then. My body just shut off. Like, I just stopped. Mm-hmm. And because I just didn't feel safe anymore or protected or supported. And it's so it's very powerful, mm-hmm. which is something that we love so much about you guys, because I don't even know you. I've just listened to a million of your podcasts and I feel so safe with you right now. I'm like, you could fly here right now and deliver my baby, because just so much about you guys, you provide so much comfort and support already. So I'm sure all of your clients can feel that from you.
Absolutely.
Yeah. And I just would like to say that, the introduction was great. That which one of you is Julie? Which one's Megan?
I'm Julie.
And I'm Megan.
Okay, great. All right. So Julie was reading the introduction and she was talking about how, if you have a breach, if you have twins, if you have a VBAC, you have all these other things, just come down to Southern California and not take care of it. But I'm not a cowboy, all right? Even though I do think that most of my colleagues in the profession do, I also say no to people sometimes. And I also, I look at things differently. I don't look just because someone has, chronic hypertension.
Right.
That they can't have a home birth. Why can't they have a home birth? The labor is just the labor. I mean, if her blood pressure gets out of control, yeah, then she has to go to the hospital. But why do you need to be labored in the hospital or induced early if everything is fine? but it's not, you know, this isn't for everybody.
Yeah, for sure.
That very clear. You need to find a supportive team or a supportive practitioner who's willing to be able to say yes and no and give you it with what we call a true informed consent so that you have the right to choose which way to go and to do what's reasonable. Our ethical obligation is to give you reasonable choices and then support your informed decision-making. And sometimes there are things that aren't reasonable. Like, for instance, an example that I use all the time is if a woman has a breech baby, but she has a placenta previa, okay, well, you know, a vaginal delivery is not. It's not an option. For you.
Yeah.
Right. Now she could say, well, I want one and I'm not going to have a C-section. And
then you have the right to refuse that. Yeah.
Yeah. But that's never going to happen because we have a good communication with our patients. No, our communication is such that we develop a trust over the period of time. Sometimes I don't meet people until I'm actually called to their house by a midwife to come assist with a vacuum or something like that. Mm-hmm. But even then, the midwives and stuff, and because I'm sort of known, that people have an understanding. And then when I'm sitting there, as long as the baby isn't in trouble, I will explain to them, here's what's going to happen. Here's how we're going to do it. The baby's head's going to look like this. Not going to be a problem. It'll be better in 12 hours. But I go through all this stuff and I say, I'm going to touch you now. Is that okay? And I ask permission.
Perfect.
And I do all the things that the midwives have taught me that I never really learned in residency program. They don't teach this stuff.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, absolutely. I think that, and one of the things that we go over a lot too in our classes is finding a provider who naturally, like, has a natural tendency to treat his patients the way that you want to be treated. And that way you'll have a lot better time when you birth because you're not having to ask them to do anything that they're not comfortable with or that they're not prepared for or that they don't know how to do. And so interviewing providers and interview as many as you need to with these women and find the provider that whose natural ways of treating his clients are the ways that you want to be treated.
And sometimes in a community, there's nobody.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's true.
And that's what's so hard.
And if it's important to you, then you have to drive 100 miles.
Or stand up for yourself and fight really hard.
Yeah. I have a client from Russia. She's flying here in 2 weeks. She's coming all the way to Salt Lake City, Utah. To have her baby. We had another client from Russia.
We have another Russian client?
Yeah.
Oh.
Awesome. So yeah, it's crazy. Like sometimes you have to go far distances and sometimes you've got them right there. You just have to search. Have to find them. So
it's tricky.
And maybe your company is not going to pay for it.
Yeah. Did you say my company's not going to pay for it?
And maybe your insurance company.
Oh, insurance. Right. Yeah, exactly.
You know, that's just not... Like you can't rely on them to be the ones who support some of these decisions that are outside of the standards of care. You might have to really figure out how to get creative around that area.
Yep, absolutely.
Yeah.
We're going to take a quick break to continue talking about fertility. I know many of our beautiful women of strength listening join us right after their cesarean birth. And when you're in your postpartum stages, many of your nutrition needs actually increase. And if you're thinking about having another baby, I invite you to take a moment to educate yourself on the support that our favorite prenatal supplement Needed offers for both fertility and postpartum. When the two founders of Needed began their fertility journey, they were shocked to see the lack of nutrition advice provided. Along with creating an amazing line of prenatal vitamins, omega-3s, and other essentials, they offer eggs quality support for women and sperm support for men. Again, this is not something we often talk about. Male fertility impacts conception and a healthy pregnancy, and it is in decline due to stress, toxins, aging, and other lifestyle factors. Hormone and gut health of your partner directly influences sperm quantity and quality, and ultimately the DNA passed from sperm to baby. I love that Needed not only thinks about the female fertility, but also about the male fertility. Needed does an amazing job thinking about and supporting us women through the fertility journey. They offer prenatals, omega-3s, antioxidant, rich in egg quality support supplements, and it is formulated by prenatal health practitioners to help you and your eggs thrive. You are born with all of your egg cells, or oocytes. And the oocyte takes 3 to 4 months to mature before ovulation. Needed egg quality support is designed to support egg cell health as they develop into mature eggs. Improving egg quality can support fertility outcomes, and it's never too early or too late to focus on egg quality. So we hope you can check out thisisneeded.com and enjoy 20% off with code VBAC20. Again, that is VBAC20 at thisisneeded.com. Back to today's show. Let's take a moment to talk about Coterie wipes, because they're just as amazing as their diapers. These wipes are made from 100% plant-based fibers and are up to 30% larger than most other brands, making them perfect for even the messiest of situations. They're also hypoallergenic and dermatologist tested, so they're safe for newborns and even eczema-prone skin. One of our team members shared that these wipes have been a game changer, gentle enough for delicate skin, but durable enough to get the job done with fewer wipes. They've even earned the National Eczema Association Seal of Acceptance. You guys, you can pair these with Coterie diapers for a high-performance diaper duo. And do not forget, you can get 20% off with code VBAC20 of your first order of $40 or more. Add a pack of these incredible wipes to your order to see the difference.
So in the beginning, Bliss, you talked about kind of noticing the signs. And I know that's one of the questions that we got on our Instagram, I believe. What birthing at home for both of you guys, you know, what signs for a VBAC mom are signs enough where you talk about different care? Or
can you
say that again? I mean, I didn't really understand that. Say what you're saying.
Yeah. Sorry. So one of the questions on our Instagram was, what are the signs of like uterine rupture that when you're at home that you look for and would transfer care or talk about a different plan of action?
Okay. Quite simply, some uterine ruptures have no prodrome. You don't have any warning that they're coming.
Right.
So there's nothing you can do about those. But before we get into what you can feel, just let's review the numbers real briefly so that people have a realistic viewpoint.
Because
I'm sure that if a doctor doesn't want to do a VBAC, he'll find a reason not to do a VBAC. He'll use the scar thickness or the pregnancy interval or whatever. They'll use something to try to talk you out of it, or your baby's too big, or this kind of thing. So we can get into that in a little bit. But when there are signs, the most common sign you would feel is that there'd be increasing pain suprapubically that doesn't go away between contractions. So it's a little different. It's a different quality of pain
sensation, maybe.
Sensation. That, you know, it's pain. It's becoming uncomfortable. You might start to have variables when you didn't have them before. So the baby's heart rate, you might see heart rate decelerations. Rarely, you might find excessive bleeding, but that's usually not a sign of, that's a sign of true rupture. So,
loss of station.
Yeah, those are things you watch for. But again, if you're not augmenting someone, if someone doesn't have an epidural where they don't have sensation, if you're not, they're not on Pitocin, these things are very unlikely to happen.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, and I was going to get to the numbers. The numbers are such that the quoted risk of uterine rupture, which is, again, that crappy word, it sounds like a tire blowing out of the freeway, is about 1 in 200. But only about 5 to 16%, and even one study I said is at 3%, but let's just even take 16% of those ruptures will result in an outcome that the baby is damaged or dead. Okay, so that's about 1 in 6. So the actual risk is about 1 in 6 times 1 in 200 or 1 in 1200 up to about 1 in 4,000.
Yep.
So those are the risks. They're not the 1 in 200 or the 2%. Or I actually had someone tell some woman that she had a 30% chance of rupture.
Oh, we've had somebody say 50%.
We have.
Yeah, Jess, our copy editor, her doctor told her that if she tries to VBAC, she has a 50% chance of rupture, and she will die. Yeah.
Wow.
Pretty scary.
Oh yeah. And by the way, maternal mortality from uterine rupture is extremely rare.
Yeah.
We were
just talking about that.
Yeah. Doctors wrong on so many accounts. I don't even know where to begin on that.
I know.
So, yeah. And see, that's the kind of thing where even if someone has a classical cesarean scar, the risk of rupture isn't 50%.
Yep.
So I don't know where they come up with those sorts of numbers.
Yeah. I think it's just a lot like, it's just their comfort level and what they're familiar with and what they know and what they understand. And I think a lot of these doctors, because she had a premature cesarean, and so that's kind of why he was a little, well, a lot more fear-based. You know, her cesarean, what happened, I think, around 32 weeks, which we still know that, like, you can still attempt a VBAC and still have a really good chance of having a successful one. But a lot of these providers just don't do it.
Yeah, and another problem is you can't really find out what somebody's C-section rate is. I mean, they're supposed to be hospital. You can find out your hospital C-section rate.
Mm-hmm.
But they can vary dramatically between different physicians. So you really don't know. You'd like to think that physicians are honest. You'd like to think that they're going to tell you the truth. But if they have a high C-section rate and it's a competitive world, they're not going to. And if you're an HMO, you don't really have a choice anyway. So
and there's not transparency on the physician level.
So Bliss was talking briefly about the fact that, you know, your insurance may not pay for it.
Yep.
So Bliss, why don't you elaborate on that? Because that's such that you do that point so well.
Are you talking about the wedding?
Yeah. I love your analogy. It's a great analogy.
I'm so saddened sometimes when people talk to me about that they really want this option, and especially VBACs. I just, you know, I have a very special tender place in my heart for VBACs because I overcame something from my first to second birth that wasn't a cesarean, but, you know, it felt like I had been led to mistrust my body, and then I had a triumphant second delivery. So I really understand how that feels when a woman is able to reclaim her body and have a vaginal delivery. But, you know, just in general, in terms of limiting your options based on what your insurance will pay for, you know, we think about the delivery of our baby or something like a wedding, you know, where it's this really special day. And I see that women or families will spend thousands and thousands of dollars and, you know, put it on a credit card and, you know, just figure out whatever they need to do to have this beautiful wedding. But somehow when it comes to the birth of their baby, they turn over all their power to this insurance company, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And so I used to say, we used to do this talk at the sanctuary, and I used to say, you know, what if we had wedding insurance and you paid every year into this insurance for your wedding, and then, you know, when the wedding came, they selected where you went and you didn't like it, and they put you in a dress that made you look terrible, and the food was horrible, and the music was horrible, and they invited all these people you didn't want to be there.
But it's a network.
Really? would you really let that insurance company, because it was paid for, dictate how your wedding day was? But somehow,
that's a good analogy.
You just let it all go.
Yeah, that's amazing. I love that. And it's so true. It is so true.
Well, and we get that too a lot about hiring a doula. You know, I can't hire a doula. It's too expensive. And we get that a lot because people don't expect to pay out of pocket for their births. When you're right, it's just perceived completely differently. And when it should be one of the biggest days of your life. I had three VBACs at home, and my first was a necessary, unnecessary, and I don't know. I'm still really uncertain about that, to be honest with you. But you better believe my VBACs at home, we paid out of pocket for a midwife. No, we put our first two times, it was put on a credit card. I had a doula, I had a birth photographer, I had a videographer. My first VBAC, I had two photographers there because, right? Like, it was gonna be documented because it was so important to me. And we sold things on eBay, and we, you know, sold our couches, and I did some babysitting just to bring in the money, and doulas. Obviously, I hired doulas because it was so important to me to not only have the experience that I wanted and that I deserved, but I wanted it documented, and I wanted it to be able to remember it well and look back on it fondly. And we see that, especially in Utah, I think we have this culture where women just don't. I don't know. It's probably, I feel like it's just a national thing, but I think it was Utah. We kind of tend to be on the cheap side just culturally, and women don't see the value in that. And it's hard because it's hard to shift that mindset and to see, like, you are important, you are worth it. What if you could have everything you wanted? And what if you knew you could be treated differently? Would you think about how to find the way to make that work financially? And I think if there's just that mindset shift, a lot of people would.
Oh, I love that.
And if you realize, you know, if you have to pay $10,000 out of pocket or $5,000, whatever, to get to at least have the opportunity. And you always have the hospital as a backup. But, you know, 2-3 years from now, that $5,000 isn't going to mean anything.
Yeah, nothing.
It's but that experience is with you forever.
So, yeah. Women may not, you know, they may not remember the names of their children when they're 80 years old, but they'll remember the birth of them.
Yeah. Well, in my cesarean baby, we had some complications, and out of pocket, I paid almost 10 grand for him. And none of my home births, midwife, doula, photography, and videography included, cost over seven.
My cesarean births in hospital were also more expensive than my birth center birth.
Anyways.
Yeah. So,
Kate, we should get to questions.
Yeah, let's keep going.
Let's get to some of the questions because you have some really good questions.
Yes.
Why don't you pick one and let's do it.
So let's do Lauren. She was on Facebook. She was our very first question, and she said that she has some uterine abnormalities, like a bicornic uterus or, you know, separate uterus or, you know, all of those. They want to know how that impacts VBAC. She's had two previous cesareans due to a breech presentation because of her uterine abnormality.
Is that the heart-shaped uterus?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
So
You can have a septate uterus. You can have a unicornate uterus. You can have a double uterus.
Yeah, two separate uteruses. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Right. As far as the biggest problem with a person with an abnormal uterine shape or an anomaly is a couple of things. One is malpresentation, as this woman experienced because her two babies were breech. And two is sometimes retained placenta is more common in women that have a septum, that sort of thing. Also, it can preterm labor and growth restriction depending on the type of anomaly of the uterus. Now, say you get to term and your baby is head down, or if it's breech in my vicinity, but if it's head down, then the chance of VBAC for that person is really high. I mean, it might be a slightly greater risk of cesarean section, but not a statistically significant risk. You know, and then success rate for home birth VBACs, if you look at the MANA stats or even my own stats, which are not enough to make statistical significance in a couple of papers that I put out, but the MANA stats show that it's about a 93% success rate for VBACs in the midwifery model. Whereas in the hospital model, it can be as low as 17% up to in the 50s or 60%, but it's not very high. And that's partly because of the model by which you're cared for. So the numbers that I'm sort of quoting and the success rates I'm quoting are, again, assuming that you have a supportive practitioner in a supportive environment. Every VBAC is going to have diminished chance of success in a restrictive or tense environment. But unicornate uterus or septate uterus is not a contraindication to VBAC, and it's not a contraindication to breech delivery if somebody knows how to do a breech VBAC too.
Right.
So Lauren, that would be my answer to your question, is that no, it's not a contraindication. And that if you have the right practitioner, you can certainly try to labor, and your risk of rupture is really not much more significant than a woman who has a normal shaped uterus.
Good answer.
So I want to kind of spin off that really quick. Yeah. It's not a question, but I've had a client myself that had two C-sections, and her baby was breech at 37 weeks. And the doctor said absolutely could not turn the baby externally because her risk of rupture was so, you know, increasingly.
It was an increased risk of rupture doing
so
the
high
external version.
So would you agree with that or would you disagree
No.
with that? Okay.
No. No, even an ACOG statement on external version and breech delivery says that a previous uterine scar is not a contraindication to attempting a external version.
Yeah.
Now, if we obviously had more breech choices, then there'd be no reason to do an external version.
Mm-hmm. Right.
The main reason that people try an external version, which can sometimes be very uncomfortable, and depending on the woman and, you know, her parity and, you know, certain other factors can be, you know, their success rate cannot be very good, is the only reason they do it because the alternative is a cesarean in, you know, 95% of locations in the country.
Okay, well, that's good to know.
But again, if one of the things I would tell people to do when they're hearing something from their physician that just sort of rocks the common sense boat and doesn't sort of make sense, look into it.
Yep.
ACOG has a lot. I think you can just go Google some of the ACOG clinical guidelines or practice guidelines or clinical opinions or whatever they call them. And you can find, and you can read through, and they summarize them at the end on level A, B, and C evidence. Mm-hmm. Level A being great evidence, level C being what's called consensus opinion. The problem with consensus, with ACOG's guidelines, is that about 2/3 of them are consensus opinion because they don't really have any data on them. Mm-hmm. And when you get a bunch of academics together who don't like VBAC or don't like home birth or don't like breech birth, of course their consensus opinion is going to be, well, we're not going to advise it.
Yeah.
But much to their credit lately, they're starting to change their tune. Their most recent VBAC guideline paper said that if your hospital can do labor and delivery, your hospital can do VBAC.
Yeah.
Yes. That's a huge thing from the immediately available fiasco that went on and the reason. So any hospital that's doing labor and delivery should be able to do a VBAC. And when they say they can't, or they say our insurance company won't let them, it's just a cowardly excuse because that, you know, maybe it's true, but they need to fight for your right, because most surgical emergencies in labor and delivery have nothing to do with a previous uterine scar.
Absolutely.
They have to do with fecal distress or placental abruption or cord prolapse. And if they can handle those, they can certainly handle the 1 in 1,200. I mean, say a hospital does 20 VBACs a year, 50 VBACs a year. It'll take them, do the math, take them 25 years to have a rupture.
Yeah. Yep. It's pretty powerful.
I love when he does.
Yeah, I know, right?
I'm like this a huge statistics junkie and data junkie. And so like those things, like I have the number.
Yeah, she loves numbers.
Yep.
I love that. Hey.
And 50 VBACs a year at 2000. Yeah. Would that be 40 years actually? Right?
Oh,
what happened? Yeah. So say that again. What was the numbers again that you said?
So 2000, 1 in 2000 ruptures are catastrophic, and they do 50 VBACs a year. Wouldn't that be?
Yeah, that's 140 years. But I was using the 1200. I was using the 1200 numbers.
Oh, right.
Yeah.
So that would be.
Which would be what, 24 years?
Right. Yeah. Right. Anyways, me and you should sit down and just talk one day. I would love to have lunch with you.
let's talk astrology and astronomy. Right?
Yes.
All right, so who's next?
So let's. Well, oh, go ahead.
Just to make a suggestion.
Yes.
So there was another woman. Let's see where it is. What's the likelihood that a baby would flip, and is it reasonable to even give it a shot for a VBA2C? How do you guys say that?
VBAC after two cesareans.
Yeah.
Sorry. You need to know the lingo. So I would say it's very unlikely for a baby to flip head down from a breech position in labor. Doesn't mean it's impossible.
Oh, with a uterine septum, it's almost never going to happen. Mm. So Liz is right on. And even trying an external version on a woman with a uterine septum, when the baby's head is up in one horn and the placenta's in the other horn, and they're in a frank breech position, that's almost futile to do that, especially if the woman is a primip or what I call a functional primip, or even a woman who's never labored before. So.
Right, that's true.
And then, Napoleon said, what did she say? Oh, she was just talking about this. She's planning on a home birth after two cesareans, supported by a midwife and a doula, and research suggests home birth is a reasonable and safe option for low-risk women. And she wants to know, in reality, what identifies low risk?
Well, I thought her question was hilarious because she says, it seems like everybody's high risk, too old, overweight, overdue, just made me...
Right. Yeah, it does. It does, though.
Well, when you immediately label someone high risk, you make them high risk.
Yep.
Mm-hmm.
Because now you've planted seeds of
doubt.
Mm-hmm. Inside their head. So I would say that, how do you define high risk? I mean, is 1 in 1,200 high risk?
Nope.
I don't seem high risk to me, but, again, I mean, we do a lot of things in our life that are a lot more dangerous than that and don't consider them high risk. So, I think the term high risk is bandied about way too much.
Mm-hmm.
And it's based on some false or some random numbers that they come up with. Bliss has heard this before. I mean, she knows everything that I say. It comes out of my mouth. But the numbers like 24, 35, 42. I mean, 24 hours of ruptured membranes. Where did that come from?
Yeah.
Or some people are saying 18 hours. I mean, there's no science on that. I mean, bacteria don't suddenly look at each other and go, hey, Ralph, it's time to start multiplying.
Ralph, I love it.
I'm going to name my bacteria
It's
Ralph.
True. And I was told after 18 hours, that was my number.
Yeah. And, again, so these numbers, there are papers that come out, but they're not repetitive. Any midwife worth her salt has had women with ruptured membranes sometimes 2, 3, 4 days.
Yep.
And as long as you're not sticking your fingers in there, And as long as, you know, their GBS might be negative, or, you know, that's another issue. I think that was
that's another question. That's another question. Yep.
Yeah, I can get to that right now. I mean, if someone has a ruptured membrane with GBS and they don't go into labor within a certain period of time, it's not unreasonable to give them the pros and cons of antibiotics and then let them make that decision. All right. We don't force people to have antibiotics. We would watch for fetal tachycardia or fever. And at that point, you know, then you're already behind the eight ball. So ideally, you'd like to see someone go into labor sooner. But again, if they're still leaking, if there's no vaginal exams, the likelihood of them getting group B strep sepsis or something on the baby is still not very high. Mm-hmm. And the thing about antibiotics that I like to say is that if I was going to give antibiotics to a woman, I think it's much better to give a woman antibiotics at home than in the hospital. And the reason being is because at home, the baby's still going to be born into their own environment, and mom's and dad's bacteria and the dog's bacteria and the sibling's bacteria. Where in the hospital, they're going to go to the nursery for observation like they generally do, and they're going to be exposed to different bacteria unless they do these vaginal seeding, which isn't really catching on universally yet, mm-hmm. where you take a swab of mom's vaginal bacteria before yeah. the C-section, and then you...
No, I was just agreeing. Oh, yeah,
seeding,
microbreathing. Right. I don't consider a ruptured membrane something that, again, would cause me to immediately say something. You have to change your plan. You individualize your care in the midwifery model.
Yep.
And you look at every patient, and you look at their history, you look at their desires, you look at their backup situation, their transport situation, that sort of thing. You take it all into account, right? Now, there are some women in pregnancy who don't want to do a GBS culture,
mm-hmm.
all right? Ignorance is bliss. The other spelling of bliss.
Hi, bliss. Right?
But the reason that at least I still encourage people to do it is because for any reason, if that baby gets transferred to the hospital during labor or after, and you don't have a GBS culture on the chart,
they're going to give it antibiotics.
They're going to treat it as GBS positive, yep. right? And they're also going to think you're irresponsible.
Yep.
And they're going to have that mentality that, like, oh, you know, here's another one of those home birth crazy people. Blah, blah, blah.
That just happened right. to me in January. I had a client like that. I mean, anyways, never mind.
Can
it's
I
not the time.
Say something of the low risk?
Yes.
So I think there's a lot of different factors that go into that question. One being, what are the state laws? Because mm-hmm. there are things that I would consider low risk and that I feel very comfortable with, but that are against the law, and I'm not mm-hmm. going to go to jail.
Mm-hmm. Right.
We want you to still... be birthing.
Yeah, that's a very good point.
Yeah.
As much as I believe in a woman's right to choose, I have to draw the line at what the law is. And then the second is finding a provider that, you know, obviously Dr. Stu feels very comfortable with things that other providers may not necessarily feel comfortable with.
Right.
And so I think it's really important, as you said in the beginning of the show, to find a provider that takes the risk that you have and feels like they can walk that path with you and mm-hmm. be supportive. I definitely agree with what Dr. Stu was saying about informed consent. And, you know, I had a client that was GBS positive, declining antibiotics, and had a very long rupture. And we continued to walk that journey together, and I kept giving informed consent and kept giving informed consent. And he had such trust and faith that it actually stretched my comfort level. And we had to continually talk about, you know, where we were in this dance. But that is, to me, that feels like what our job is mm-hmm. to give them information about the pros and cons and let them decide for themselves.
Yep.
And I think that if you take a statistic, I'm picking an arbitrary number, and you know, there's a 94% chance of success and a 4% chance that something could go really wrong. One family might look at that and say, wow, 94%, this is me. That sounds pretty good statistic. And
yeah.
one person might 4% makes me really uncomfortable.
Mm-hmm.
I need to minimize that. So I think that's where you have to have the ability, given who you surround yourself with and who your provider is, to be able to say, this is my choice and it's being supported. So it is arbitrary in a lot of ways, except for when it comes to what the law is.
Yeah, right? That makes sense.
And I love that. Yeah.
And every state has their own laws. Like in the mm-hmm. South, like it's legal to, like in lots of places in the South, I think in Washington too, like midwives can't support home birth if you're VBAC. And I mean, there's lots of different legislative
rules.
Why am I saying legislative? Look at me. I'm trying to use fancy words to impress you guys. There's lots of different laws in different states. And some of them are very evidence-based and some of them are some laws are broad and they leave a lot of room for practice
areas.
And variation and gray areas, right? And some are so specific that they really limit a woman's option in that state.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, we can have a whole podcast on the legal decision-making process and the right of and a woman's right to autonomy of her body,
yeah.
And the choices and who gets to decide. That would be, right now the vaccine issue is a big issue, but also pregnancy and restricting women's choices of these things. We could do it. If you want to do another one down the road, I would love to talk on that subject with you guys.
Perfect.
We would love.
Yeah, I think it's your most recent episode. I mean, as of the time of this recording, mandates kill medicine? Is that the name?
Mandates destroy medicine.
Yeah, mandates destroy medicine.
Yeah. It's a wonderful.
Yeah,
wonderful.
I love it. I was just listening to it today again.
Yeah, well, it does because it makes physicians agents of the state.
Yeah, mm-hmm. It really does. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Well, if you give us another opportunity to do this with you, heck yeah.
Yeah, you can just be a guest every month.
Yes. Okay, so.
I would mind that at all, actually.
We would love it.
Yeah.
We would seriously love it.
Well, we'll keep in touch.
So. Couple other questions I'm trying to see because we kind of jumped through like a few that kind of were the same. I know one asks about an overactive pelvic floor, meaning too strong, not too weak. She's wondering if that is going to affect her chances of having a successful VBAC.
And do you see that a lot with athletes, like people that are overtrained and or that maybe not overtrained, but like that train a lot and like weightlifters and things like that, where their pelvic floor is too strong? I've heard of that before.
Yep. Absolutely. There's a chiropractor here in LA, Dr. Elliot Berlin, who also has his own podcast.
Isn't Elliot Berlin Heads Up? Berlin.
Yeah, he's a producer Heads Up. Right?
Yeah, I listened to your guys' special episode on that too. But yeah, he's wonderful.
Yeah. So again, I think this is a question that just has more to do with vaginal delivery than it does necessarily about the fact that they've had a previous cesarean. So I do believe that the athletic pelvis has really affected women's deliveries. And I think that during pregnancy, we can work with a pelvic floor specialist who can help us be able to realize where the tension is and how to do some exercises that might help alleviate some of that. We have a specialist here in LA, I don't know if you guys do there, that I would recommend people to. And then also, maybe backing off on some of the athletic activities that woman is participating in during her pregnancy and doing things more like walking, swimming, yoga, stretching, belly dancing, which was originally designed for women in labor, not to seduce men. So these are all, really good things to keep things fluid and soft because you want things to open and release rather than being
down. Yeah, for sure.
So
I love that.
And I agree. I think sometimes it leads more to not generally so much of dilation, but the second, and again, I don't really. A friend of mine, David Hayes, he's a home birth guy in South Carolina, doesn't like the idea of using stages of labor. He wants to get rid of that. And I think that's an interesting thought. Mm. We have a meeting this November in Wisconsin. We're going to have a bunch of thought things going on over there. But,
is it going to be all men talking about this?
Oh, hell
yeah.
No.
Oh.
Let's get more women.
No. It's being organized by Cynthia Calais. Do you guys know who Cynthia is?
No,
been a midwife for 50 years, and she's in Wisconsin. She's done hundreds of breaches, she says. Anyway, the point being is that I think that I find that a lot of those people end up getting instrumented, like vacuums.
Right.
More commonly, I think. Yeah, so Bliss is right. I mean, there are people who are very, very tight down there. The levators and the muscles inside are very tight, which is great for life and sex and all that other stuff. But yeah, you need to learn how to be able to relax them too.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
So I know we're running short on time, but this question that came through today, I loved it. Said, could you guys both replicate your model of care nationwide somehow? She said, how do I advocate effectively for home birth access and VBAC access in a state that actively prosecutes home birth and has restrictions on midwifery practice? She specifically said she's in Nebraska, but we know we hear this all over the place. You know, VBAC is not allowed. You cannot birth at home. And, you know, people are like having unassisted births.
Because they can't find the support.
They can't find the support and they are too scared to go to the hospital or there's not birth centers, you know. And so, yeah.
The question is, what can women do in their local communities to advocate for positive change and more options in birth where they are more restricted?
I wish I had a really great answer for this. I think that the biggest thing is to continue to talk out loud. And I'm really proud of you ladies for creating this podcast and doing the work that you do. But I think that we, you know, I always believed when we had the sanctuary that, you know, it really is about the woman advocating for herself. And the more that hospitals and doctors are being pushed by women to say, we need this as an option because we're not getting the work, I think is really important. And I feel, you know, I support free birth, and I think that most of the women and men who decide to do that are very well educated. Are really actually very surprising for midwives to see that sometimes they even have better statistics than we do. But it saddens me that there's no choice. And, and a woman who totally feel comfortable with doing that is feeling forced into that decision. So I think as women, we need to support each other, encourage each other, continue to talk out loud about what it is that we want and need, and make this be a very important decision that a woman makes. And it's a way of reclaiming her power. I'm not highly political. I try and kind of stay out of those arenas. And really, one of my favorite quotes from a reverend that I have been around said, you know, be for something and against nothing. And I really believe I like that. The more that we, you know, speak positively and talk about positive change and empowering ourselves and each other, that it may come slowly, but that change will continue to come.
Yeah, and
I would only add to that that I think, unfortunately, in any country, whether it, you know, whether it's a socialist country or a capitalist country, it's the economics that drives everything. And you look at countries like England or the Netherlands, you find that you know, they have a really integrated system with midwives and doctors collaborating, and the low risk patients are taken care of by the midwives, and then they consult with doctors, and midwives can transfer from home to hospital and continue their care in that system, the national health system. You know, I'm not saying that's the greatest system for somebody who's growing old and has arthritis or needs spinal surgery or something like that, but for obstetrics, you know, sort of that sort of system where you've taken out liability and you've taken out economic incentive. All right. So how do you do that in our system? It's not very easy to do because everything is essentially driven. One of the things that I've always advocated for is if you want to lower the C-section rate, increase the VBAC rate, be really simple. If insurance companies, as long as they're still, until we have, you know, Bernie Sanders, universal health care, but while we have insurance companies, if they would just pay twice as much for a vaginal birth and half as much for a cesarean birth.
Yep. There you go.
VBACs and breach deliveries would be something, oh, you know what, maybe we should be more supportive of those things because it's all about the money. But as long as the hospital gets paid more, doctors don't really get paid more. They get, it's expediency for the doctor. He gets it done and goes home.
Yeah.
But in the hospital, they get paid a lot more, almost twice as much for a C-section than you do for a vaginal birth. What's the incentive for the chief financial officer of any hospital to say to the OB department, you know, we need to lower our C-section rate? Now, one of the things that's happening, there are programs that are got an insurance and I forgot what it's called, but where they're trying in California, they're trying to lower the primary C-section rate. There's a term for it where it's like PRIMIP, pre-labor, in-labor. There's an acronym with four initials. List, do you know what I'm talking about?
No. No?
Do you know what he's talking about?
I think of the CMQC, whatever, but that's not the same.
No. It's an acronym about a first time mom. We're trying to avoid those C sections.
Mm-hmm. The primary cesarean.
It's an acronym. Anyway, nonetheless, so they're in the right direction. They're trying to lower it from the, most hospitals are in the 30% range. They'd like to lower it to 27%. Mm-hmm. That's a start.
Mm-hmm.
One of the ways to really do that is to support VBAC and treat VBACs, as Bliss said at the very beginning of the podcast, is that we don't treat a VBAC is just a normal labor. When people lump VBAC in with breech and twins, it's like, why are you doing that?
Yep.
I mean, breech and twins requires special skill.
It requires
a special skill also, which is a skill of doing nothing.
Yeah.
and it's hard. It's hard for obstetricians and labor delivery nurses and stuff like that to do nothing. But ultimately, VBAC is just a vaginal birth and doesn't require any special skill. And when a doctor says we don't do VBAC, what he's basically saying, or she, is that I don't do vaginal deliveries, which is sort of stupid because the VBAC is just a vaginal delivery.
Yeah, that's true.
Such a powerful point right there.
Well, guys, we loved chatting with you so much. We wish we could talk with you all day long.
All day long. Yeah, I just want to be a fly on your walls.
Yeah.
If I could.
If you're ever in Salt Lake City.
Again, did you know
come
that?
Come say hi to Adrian, but also connect with us because we would love to meet you. All right. Well, guys, everyone, all of our listeners, Women of Strength, we are going to drop all the information that you need to find Midwife Bliss and Dr. Stu, their website, their podcast, all of that in our show notes. So, now you can find our podcast. You can even listen to our podcast on our website, thevbacklink.com/podcast. You can play episodes right from there. So if you don't know, if you're listening to this podcast, then you probably have a podcast player already. But you know what? My mom still doesn't know what a podcast is. So I'm just going to have to start sending her links right to our page.
Yep. Just listen to us wherever and leave us a review and head over to Dr. Stu's podcast and leave them a review.
Subscribe because you're going to love him. But don't stop listening to him because you love us too. Remember that.
And I want to thank everybody that wrote in. I'm sorry we didn't get to answer every question. We tend to blather on a little bit, but asking these important questions, and hopefully you guys will have us back on again.
We would love to have you.
Absolutely.
Yep, we will. Absolutely.
Yeah.
Would you like to be a guest on the podcast? Head over to thevbacklink.com/share to submit your story. For information on all things VBAC, including online and in-person VBAC classes, the VBAC blog, the worldwide database for VBAC doulas, and more, head over to thevbacklink.com. Congratulations on starting your journey of learning and discovery with the VBAC Link.
Hey, everybody. I just wanted to take a quick sec to thank you all so much for listening to today's episode. We are so glad that you are here. This community is near and dear to our heart. We love you all so much. If you enjoyed today's episode, we would really appreciate it if you'd leave us a rating and review. Our whole team here at the VBAC Link actually gets to see these reviews come in, and it makes our day. A 5-star rating helps us share our podcast and gets these important messages out there. Thank you so much for listening, and we cannot wait to see you next time.